Welcome to the Archives of the Loralee Show, Conversation for Exploration, timeless discussions to challenge and expand our worldview. And while you may find our guests fascinating, the views expressed may not necessarily reflect those of our own or of the Cuyamangue Institute. That's why we call it Conversation for Exploration. And join in our ongoing live events, interviews, our own presentations, and much, much more as we go exploring. Learn more at CuyamangueInstitute.com and Loralee.com. And hello there, I'm Loralee, and thanks for tuning into Conversation for Exploration. We're joining John Matthews from Oxford, England tonight. And let me tell you a little bit about John. He and his wife are some of the foremost historians on the Arthurian legend, on Celtic shamanism, and many other related topics. I'd say frequent workshop teachers to America and elsewhere around the world. And John, because we have such limited time with you tonight, I want to ask you the question that I think part of the revival of ancient wisdom today, and you're doing such a good job of helping bring some of those threads back and making sure the tapestry of today's culture has woven them in today, which I think is an important process. So much that you've explored, I would like to know, why is that significant to people today? What have you learned in detail of that as you answer, but what can we learn from some of these ancient traditions, and why is it important to add this back into the mix and to revive it and reinterpret it to some extent today?
Well, I think that as with any ancient tradition, it is a very circular thing. There are things that we knew and discovered about in those very ancient times which are still relevant today, because although the time has moved on, we as people have tended to remain remarkably unchanged on certain levels. We still need the same things. We still need to be reassured and guided and helped by, you know, inner powers, by the deities and qualities that we've sought over throughout time. Mm. I think this is very true, especially with the Celtic material that I work with, or that Catelyn and I work with, which have a lot to do with the way in which one comes in contact with the natural world. This in a time when the ecological movement is so strong, I think is very important. Just altogether with a sense of wanting to belong more deeply to the universe, of wanting to be identified with the natural world, of wanting to look back at the great traditions and values that are still relevant to us today, and to work with those. I mean, I think working with them is the most important thing. Mm-hmm. Neither of us are mere, if I can use such a word, historians. We actually take it further into the level of practice, because I think the practicality of all this, the way that it can teach us things about ourselves, about our world, and help us to integrate those things is as important today as it was thousands of years ago.
Oh, I agree. Not to just be armchair philosophers or historians, but to actually recognize its value and integrate it, put it into practice today in a living way, because that's how the ancients were practicing this.
Exactly.
I think what's really missing today in our paradigm is a sense of the sacred, of our place in the world and the place in the universe and world itself as being sacred. And so I think we tend to go back to what's missing for balance. Tell me a little bit about how you put some of these principles, if you can identify some of them are most useful for today, and how do you put them into practice? What do you do, actually?
We both practice and teach Celtic shamanism. Now, shamanism is probably the single oldest spiritual practice that we have any knowledge of. I mean, there were shamans around probably in the Stone Age, and there are still practicing shamans in certain cultures today, and people like ourselves who are trying to revive some of those things for modern people. Shamanism really is about anchoring yourself very firmly in the reality of the universe. It's about connecting with gods, connecting with nature, connecting with the whole universe. If you think of our journey through time and space as something like a straight line, even though in fact it's not, if you think for a moment of that, And then you think of the way in which we might be trying to follow this line, but are in fact wandering away from it. So we're following a line which curves around and out and sometimes far away and sometimes closer to that central line. Then I would say that shamanism is about trying to find your way back to that central point and being aware of that central point and working with it. And this has all kinds of applications. It helps us to come to terms with our spiritual needs and our spiritual search. It helps us with healing. A lot of the work that Catelyn and I do has to do with healing at a soul level. Not so much with physical ailments such as broken bones, but some of the causes of major illnesses are often caused by a sense of being disconnected, a sense of being broken away from the real direct central point of our lives and of creation.
You know, I was just reading where some research had come forward to demonstrate that one's emotional state, if it's been sabotaged, can actually result in physical ailments. I was reading about Roger Fouts earlier today told us about some animal experiments where they put animals under stress. So sad to read about these. And yeah, the animals came down with heart disease and all sorts of other ailments physically. And also, I was reading about an observation of women that John Gottman had. He's one of the world's experts on marriages and what creates a healthy marriage. And he said that there is research there that women in an abusive marriage come down more than average with cancer and other kinds of debilitating diseases. So again, there you see it. They're demonstrated in certain research.
Well, absolutely. I mean, one of the teachings that that we work with is the idea that the soul itself can be fragmented, that parts of the soul can break off, if you like, at certain points due to to shock or to abusive relationships.
So that's why the shamans go back and have soul retrieving ceremonies and therapies. If you can tell us more about that. And let's spend the next hour talking with John Matthews about some of this very ancient wisdom and how to put it into practice today. I'm Laura Lee. We have the next hour to spend with John Matthews and his 20 years of research into the Arthurian legend, into British mythology, back to the Celtic and shamanistic origins. And I asked John, there's so much to talk about. My gosh, you and your wife, Caitlin, have written over 60 books over 20 years. What's most important that we can focus on tonight? And he said this idea of the soul fragmenting. Boy, when you look at all the mental illness and the fractured psyches and just the general spiritual malaise of our society today, I think he's on something. And we really don't have a system in place in our hospitals and psychologists and therapists and all that in the Western sense to really do something like this, put the soul back together, because they have a whole different understanding of what that soul is. So I think there's much to learn in a new light from ancient wisdom revived about what the soul is and how to keep our soul intact and healthy and optimally functioning. John, I'm very curious about this. I also want to mention that the two books, I asked you what two of your 60 books would most relate to this, he says, are Healing the Wounded King and The Celtic Shaman. So, John, take it away, and let's hear more about this intriguing concept that actually is quite universally held among shamanic traditions and cultures.
That's right, yes. I think wherever you go in the world, whatever culture you look at, whether you're looking at Aboriginal Australian or Native American or Celtic or any of these cultures which have or had a shamanic tradition, you find the concept of soul fragmentation and soul loss. These things usually come about because of something like a broken relationship or a child abuse or indeed wife abuse or any of these things that can cause very deep wounds in our consciousness, in our psyche, and indeed in our souls. And this is why in shamanic tradition you have the concept of the soul retrieval. In this, the shaman takes a journey on your behalf or helps you to make a journey to recover those lost parts and to get them back together with you. And I've seen some pretty amazing things happen as a result of this.
I mean, could you describe it?
Well, basically, what happens is that in most cases, your client comes to you and you sit down and discuss the problem, first of all. You identify what the problem is And then you either make a journey on their behalf or they make a journey with you into what we call subtle reality, which means going out of ordinary everyday consciousness into the subtle realms, into what we call the other world. And in the other world, you meet certain characters, you undergo certain journey scenarios, you find things that have been hidden away, things that have been lost, things that either you or other people have taken away and placed in a little box. It's like you could take part of your soul, which is frightened or disturbed by things that have happened to you, and lock it away in another part of your consciousness, in another place altogether. What the shaman does, or helps you to do, is to undertake a journey to get back that part, to identify that lost part, and to bring it back into the whole realm of your soul.
What's fascinating is that there's this territory to these subtle realms. It's mapped. There is a consistency to the journeys, the characters, the archetypes that you meet there. Also, the question of the multiple personality syndrome comes up. But what's your perspective, working with fractured souls in their recovery and putting them back together as you do in shamanic traditions, and that understanding from a shamanic perspective, with how do you compare and contrast that to the idea of a multiple personality syndrome, somebody whose personality or soul psyche has been fractured by abuse, stress, trauma, into separate identities?
Well, there is a kind of relationship, although I feel that the two are not the same, certainly. I think that with the idea of the multiple personality, you're often looking at something which is maybe a manifestation of something deeper, something that comes out of the, as you said, out of episodes of pain or distress in one's life, can obviously affect the consciousness in a very particular way. But I also think that it goes deeper than just the consciousness, that it actually does go down to the soul level. I mean, you know, different people have different concepts of what the soul is. To me, anyway, you know, it is a subtle part of ourselves that is both at one with us and also separate. It's something that has an existence in those inner realms. And as you said, there is a remarkable degree of similarity almost wherever you go in the kind of things that you see. You know, we have the idea of what one might call the triple-decker universe, the upper world, the middle world, and the lower world.
I like
this
that.
This comes into Celtic tradition just as it does
to double-decker buses. Good analogy. I'm sorry, I missed the last sentence.
It's just something that comes into whatever culture, you know, you're into, this idea of three worlds. And very much the kind of things that happen there, the kind of things that you see there, the kind of beings that you meet there, all have a very strong similarity. You can take people who have no knowledge of this whatsoever. I was in Seattle last week teaching a course on Celtic shamanism, and I had several people there who had no prior knowledge whatsoever of Celtic tradition, who felt drawn to it perhaps because they had relatives who had, you know, several generations back who were from Scotland or Ireland or Wales, tuning into this and coming out with the most extraordinary pieces of information that, as far as I was concerned, they could not have had access to before, and finding patterns in their lives and in their understanding which were so similar to the traditions that I've worked with over the last 20 years that it was absolutely astonishing.
That's exciting.
And this happens over and over. I mean, this happens, you know, in all the courses I teach, you always get people who have this remarkable way of keying into very ancient traditions. And the patterns there are so similar that, you know, you can't dismiss it. You can't dismiss it as coincidence or trickery or any of that. I mean, the
proof is there. Or
figments
of the imagination. Is this the same dreamscape that we go to on a nightly basis, or related territory?
It's a related territory in a certain way, in that you can access it from dream. But it's much more solid and it's much more detailed, and you can go back to exactly the same place again and again, which in most cases, unless you're very experienced in dream work, you can't do. In this case, you can make a journey, let's say, to the underworld, encounter a certain teacher or a certain ancestral lore, and then in the next journey you can go back to exactly the same place and continue it, rather like reading the next chapter in a book.
Oh, interesting. What are the signs of soul fracture? How do these symptoms show up, and how widespread in the general population do you suppose it is?
I think it's pretty extensive, actually, and it comes up in all kinds of different ways, in loss of energy, loss of interest in life, what we call power loss, which means that you simply, you know, don't have the energy or the strength to deal with almost anything that comes your way in life, a sense of depression, lingering kind of feelings of sadness for no particular reason that you can find. All kinds of things that we're very used to finding in our lives every day.
And used to giving Prozac for if you're a standard medical doctor.
Absolutely, yes. I'm very strongly against the use of drugs of any kind. I mean, although there are, of course, extensive shamanic traditions about the use of drugs, I personally don't advocate that because I feel you can get the same results without them and without any of the side effects.
And the shamans certainly weren't using Prozac, which just wants to dull you rather than awaken your senses.
Yeah.
So what are some of those ways to enter the realm? As you say, you don't have to do it with drugs. It's really breathing techniques. Lots of different techniques have been given us through the ages.
Well, we primarily use a sound source of some kind. I mean, I use a drum, even though it's not particularly traditional to the Celts, mm-hmm. Because it happens to work very well. A persistent drum beat, which is roughly the same or a little faster than the heartbeat, when listened to without interruption, can very quickly put you into a kind of light trance. I mean, this is not a kind of scary thing that is going to, you know, do anything horrendous to you or get you somewhere that you can't get back from. It simply takes you a little bit to one side of the river of your daily life. It puts you just a little bit outside that. And once you're in that state, then it is possible to access what I call the other worlds, and to interface with beings who have their own completely separate existence there. These are neither the product of one's imagination, or neither are they kind of things that are somehow connected to us. They're not coming out of our subconscious. I don't believe this. I believe that they have a separate existence of their own.
Do you think some UFO encounters and some abductions by alien stories have their origin in some of these
realms
beings? I think
it's possible. Mm-hmm. Certainly there's something in our subconscious that is very prone to this. I mean, I think Jung was right when he suggested that, you know, that a lot of our sightings of UFOs came out of a deep spiritual need to see something extraordinary and wonderful that was somehow separate from us. Mm-hmm. What is different is that they've become threatening, in sometimes life-threatening.
And how do you account for that?
The stories tend to get, you know, you tend to get this the idea that you've been kidnapped or taken away and had terrible experiments done to you. This, of course, is very different from any kind of encounters that you have in the other world.
Are they all benevolent beings there?
Well, I wouldn't say they're all benevolent. They can sometimes be quite harsh in their treatment of us, but it's always for a good end, and it never happens on the physical level, if you know what I mean. In other words, that in the spiritual and subtle realm, where you're working very much with the energies of the soul, all kinds of extraordinary things can happen. You can be cut up and put into a cauldron and boiled up and brought back to life again, mm-hmm. but you don't feel any of this in your physical body. What's happening is that it's the subtle body, the, you know, the soul part that's being worked upon.
Yep.
So the most extraordinary things like that can happen. You know, but the long-term effects, as far as I've observed over a number of years of working with this, are always positive. You don't have the sense of, you know, a kind of lingering inner fear or terror that seems to me to come with the idea of the UFO or the alien kidnapping. I mean, look at the way we represent aliens in movies. You know, you've only got to look at the latest Aliens movie, Alien Resurrection, to see this. You know, these are terrifying, frightful, fearsome beings. Mm-hmm. I've certainly never encountered anything like that in the other world.
Well, also, there's been a long tradition of imagery of demons, and so I would think that the aliens are just kind of the modern day version of the demons that have been represented from time immemorial. We're going to come right back with John Matthews. I have a few more questions for you. I have one question that I really have to ask you about King Arthur, something that was related to last week's show, and then let's open up the phones. I'm Laura Lee. Talking with John Matthews. You're also an expert on historian on Arthurian mythology. Mm-hmm. And I have just a quick question about King Arthur I need to ask. Last week, Gunnar Thompson, our guest, mentioned Avalon across the Western Sea, beautiful mm-hmm. mythical land. And Gunnar was saying, you know, it might have been America because he believes that there were maps of North America even back then, that there were travelers for thousands of years to the America long before Columbus. So a little bit about about Avalon, if you would, and do you suppose it might have been America? What did it have to say, really?
I'm not sure about that one. I mean, Avalon is really another name for the other world.
So you're seeing it in a more of a mystical sense, okay.
Absolutely, yes. I mean, in Celtic tradition, it's called Avalach, and that's really the word from which Avalon comes. So there is a quite well-established tradition taking that particular place or state of consciousness back quite a long way. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was interested, in fact, in hearing the trailer for the book about the discovery of America, because, of course, the Celts left a lot of indications that they did reach the North American continent. That there are quite strong traditions of of the early seafarers getting to a land of plenty and promise, which they certainly saw it as. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that that's quite the same as Avalon. Avalon is much more of a mystical place. Mm-hmm. Again, it's the other world, really, or even a place between this world and the other world.
Or they might have gotten to North America and given it that name because it also fit. I mean, it could have an existence in both realities,
too. It's not impossible,
too.
Certainly. Yeah. It's not impossible.
And what were you going to say?
I was only going to say that was why Arthur, is seen as going to Avalon at the end of his life. Because it's almost like a staging post between this life and the next.
One other question I have about Arthur is, a historical person, you can date him probably to 530, I have heard from other sources. Do you agree with that?
And yes, I do, mm-hmm. kind of. I mean, it's very hard to say. I think that after looking at this, at all the material relevant to this over about 35 years, I am still not 100% sure that there was a real Arthur. I think there may have been more than one, in fact. There may have been several people who took that name because it was a name associated with a particular kind of power and strength.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, he wasn't a king either. I mean, he was a leader of battles rather than a warrior, rather than actually a king in the sense that we understand it today. But certainly there was someone around. The most one can say with absolute certainty is that there was someone in the 5th or 6th centuries, who in Britain welded together these feuding and fighting Celtic tribes and helped them to drive out the invading Saxons, or certainly to pin down the invading Saxons around the coastline for about 40 years. Someone definitely did that. If it wasn't Arthur, then it was an Arthur-like figure. Mm-hmm. That's all one can say with absolute certainty.
Next question is, why this set of myths? I mean, myths seem to have their own life, and then they seem to find somebody to attach themselves to, and they grow mm-hmm. larger in proportion, my take on it. But could you tell me a little bit about the transition from an ordinary person into a mythical figure? I mean, you almost see that with Diana a little mm-hmm. bit. I mean, at least that helps me explain this phenomenon over her death recently.
Yes.
But and then having multiple historical persons taking the name Arthur would tend to add how he got so textured and multi-layered, I guess. But tell me a little bit and the significance of the Arthurian legend, just real quickly.
Well, I think that I think you've actually put your finger on it quite nicely, because in a way, I think Arthur, like many of the other figures who became associated with him, such as Merlin, are really based in archetypal forms. Arthur is the archetypal great king. Merlin is the archetypal great wizard. Lancelot and Guinevere are the archetypal great lovers. And I think that with traditions like this, you tend to get an accumulation of these extraordinary archetypal figures collecting together. And of course, the storytellers are the ones who kept these things alive. I mean, it's probable that, even before the Arthur figure, let's say, was even dead, stories were already being put about his extraordinary powers and abilities. And I think that as soon as the last of the Arthur figures had vanished, because they aren't even said to die in the stories, as soon as they'd gone, more stories began to be told about their wonderful deeds, how extraordinary mm-hmm. they were, how they hadn't really died.
Mm-hmm. And this could explain the Elvis stories too, you know.
Exactly. We yeah. don't like our great heroes to die. I mean, it's happened throughout history. We have, you know, people like Winston Churchill here in Britain. People were heard to remark that he wasn't really dead. He wasn't really in the coffin at the time of the great funeral. People have refused in the States there to believe that John Kennedy died. I mean, all kinds of things like this, you know. I mean, wherever you have a figure that's a very central importance to people in some way, they don't want to believe that they really are gone. And
well,
so
also,
these traditions spring up.
Dying young, dying before your time, and dying tragically seems to also add to the mythology. So we have Marilyn, we have Elvis, we have, you know, numerous people, James Dean and all that. So I think that's part of the formula to become a mythic figure.
I think it is, and I think it's interesting that you mentioned Princess Diana, because, you know, that was undoubtedly an example of a real human being who is being virtually, as we sit here talking, being turned into an archetype, you know, or being keyed into an archetype, perhaps. I mean, there are associations with the great goddess Diana being talked about. I've heard people using terms like saint. You know, I mean, this is really extraordinary. We're actually living in a time when we're seeing an archetype created.
Okay, fellow adventurers, as you sit around our dinner table, let's hear your questions, your comments for John Matthews on retrieval of the soul, Allah, a very ancient shamanistic and useful shamanistic practice. Again, part of the Celtic tradition and many other shamanistic traditions. Or you might ask him about the Arthurian legends. John has written a number of books on both. John, the Arthurian legends, I'm just wondering, King Arthur, whoever he was, it might have been multiple people, kept the Saxons away for some 40 years. So he didn't actually die young. I mean, he has... Part of his kingly attributes are kind of the older yet handsome king and all of that. There must be a deeper significance than tragic death at an early age, because there's so much deep mythology in the attributes to this Arthurian legend. And did it have its origins where, do you suppose? And what's some of the deep significance? Why is it a gripping story, in other words, so many years later?
Well, I think the main reason why we're still fascinated by it today is because there are so many elements that we can identify with. I mean, you know, the stories as they've come down to us through the filter of time, relate to love, to religion, to spirituality, to magic.
Betrayal.
Or many things that we're still very interested in today. If you go back really to the root of it all, I think it really goes back to the old traditions of the sacred king, to the idea that the king was almost a priest as well, was a mediator in some way between his subjects and the gods. I think in Arthur's case, the reason why he became so, or was seen as so important, was not just the historical one of the fact that he was a great leader, perhaps a very charismatic figure, but also because he represented the relationship between the king and the land. In Celtic tradition particularly, this is a very strong relationship. It's so strong that the king is even seen to have married the land in some way. It's a partnership. And the land itself being a sacred place from which you can draw sustenance or support, from which you can with which you can connect at a very deep level. I mean, this goes back to the shamanic idea again, as I said before, the idea that shamanism in some way enables you to make a very deep connection with the natural world. I think this is all a part of it, the idea that the land itself is sacred. You know, this is why we have motherlands and fatherlands all over the world. These are places that have such a very strong, important connection for us that we actually see them as mothers or fathers. You know, the land gives us birth. So Arthur himself was given birth by the land of Britain and became very closely associated with it in a mystical way as well as in a historical context.
Which is why you have those other worldly connections, the Lady of the Lake and pulling the sword from the stone, and Merlin, that element of magic, and really keeping harmony among the affairs of man helps keep harmony in that relationship, and it all goes well.
Merlin seems to have been trying to build a kind of perfect a perfect earthly realm, if you like, a kind of spiritual paradise on earth with the help of Arthur. It didn't quite work out, but it was a very good try.
Never does with mankind, does it?
No, it doesn't.
It's part of the journey, part of the challenge. Barbara in Santa Cruz, listening to KQSB. Hi, thanks for joining us. You're on with John Matthews.
Hi, thank you. I have some. I never got to meet my real father, but I have this great longing to go back to Bolton, England, and see the Abbey there.
I think a lot of people feel this. Certainly, when I'm teaching in the States, I get a lot of people who come to me and say, "Well, you know, my great-great-great-grandfather or grandmother was from England or something like that. And, you know, can I really reconnect with my roots?" I think this is something that a lot of people feel in the States. You know, they feel a certain rootlessness. You know, they know that they're American, but they also feel in some way that at some point in time they were German or Italian or French or English. And I think shamanism actually does address this, because one of the ways in which a lot of the work is done is by connecting with what I would call the primal ancestors. That is to say, not so much a real physical person from your own family line, but a kind of deep primal being who represents all of Celticness, if you like, or all of Germanness, or all of Italianness, so that in each case you can actually get back into a sense of rootedness with your own traditions by working in this way.
I know how you feel, Barbara. I have ancestors on one side of my family that trace back into many, many centuries back to England, Wales, and Ireland. So it's fun. This is one of my curiosities as well, which is why we have John on the show. Thanks, Barbara. Andy is in Madison, Wisconsin, WTDY. Hello, Andy.
I'm a first-time caller. Mm-hmm. John, it's really great to talk to you. I've had so many questions. I just picked up your book, HoloQuest.
Mm-hmm.
About 2 years before that, I had bought the Arthurian Tarot.
Right.
And I've been doing some sort of self-discovery with this, and I've been really connecting with the character in mythology named Bran.
Oh, yes.
And I've been reading in the HoloQuest and the other book, and I've been finding some information. I just wondered if you could talk more about that character.
About the character of Bran? Yeah, well, he's quite interesting because this is a character who comes from Welsh mythology. Mm-hmm. He is said to have been a great king of Britain. This is going back a good few hundred years before Arthur's time. It's a long and rather complex story, but at the end of his life, one of the interesting things is that at the end of his life, he was wounded in the thigh with a poisoned spear. And feeling that he was about to die, he told his followers to cut off his head and take it with them to a secret place, an island called Gwales. And they did this, and the head did not die. It was rather like the head of Orpheus. It continued to talk to them and sing songs and tell stories. And as long as they listened to it, and as long as they remained on this secret island, they didn't get any older. They had no fears. They had no worries or concerns. But they were also told that they mustn't open a certain door which looked in a particular direction. Well, of course, for I think it was 22 years, they managed not to open the door. But then finally, human curiosity got the better of them, and so they opened the door and looked through it. And all they really saw through that door was their homeland just across the water. But of course, as soon as they saw that, they began to remember all the things that had happened to them. They began to remember the people who had died in battle, their own fears and worries, and at the same moment the head of Bran began to die. And so he said that they should take the head back to Britain and bury it under a place called the White Mount, which is generally now believed to be the site of the Tower of London. And as long as it was there, there would be no danger would ever befall the land. Now, this story in itself is interesting for a number of reasons, because in later Arthurian tradition, Arthur is said to have dug up the head because he believed that only he could guard the land and no one else. And the other interesting point is that the name Bran and the qualities associated with Bran as a wounded being get passed down into the Arthurian tradition in the Grail stories, where you have this wonderful character known as the Wounded King, something that I've written about extensively, as a kind of type of a representation of the woundedness that we all feel in our lives in one way or another, and that manifests in different ways. You've got all those other things coming down to the present.
And a nice synchronicity, the Wounded King is one of the archetypes that relates very directly to the fragmentation of the soul, as you were talking earlier.
Absolutely, yeah. This is the crossover point between my two streams of interest in the Arthurian tradition and shamanism, because that figure, you know, of a king who has a wound that will not heal is such a very strong archetype, which I think many people today resonate with, in a sense that they feel that they have wounds that won't heal, that can't heal. These are not physical wounds, they're wounds of the spirit or wounds of consciousness that require to be addressed in a particular way.
Mm. Andy, it sounds like you have worked with this material for some time, or you're just getting into it in a big way. It resonates pretty deeply. And
well, I've worked for some time now. It all started, shall I tell you how it all began?
Mm. Yes, please.
I was actually traveling and teaching in the States about 5 years ago, and a couple of people came to me within the space of 2 or 3 days. One who was an old friend and one who was someone on one of my workshops that I'd not met before. And both of them came to me independently and said, something terrible has just happened to me. I've lost a relative. My marriage has broken up, this kind of thing. Can you suggest anything that might help me just get my life back together because I feel so devastated? And into my head came this little thought, tell them about the Wounded King. So I told them a very brief story. A very brief version of this story, and said, now go meditate on that. Well, they went off. I thought nothing of it. 2 or 3 days went by, and then I had ecstatic phone calls saying, this is amazing. My life's been completely transformed by working with this story. Hmm. So from that point on, I began to explore working with this, initially with a few friends, and then gradually extending it to larger groups, and finally to workshops. And the results have been quite remarkable. By applying shamanic techniques to this story and using it in soul retrieval and healing work, we've had some pretty extraordinary results. You know, people with really, really big difficulties in their lives finding answers and solutions to this.
Boy, that's fascinating. And it pays, as you know, to pay attention to those little voices. They have messages, and to step out where they lead. Next call, Daniel, Sacramento, KST. Hi, Daniel.
Hi. I have a kind of sideways question regarding the Arthurian legend that was kind of popped in my head when I saw the movie Excalibur. Mm-hmm. And in some of the war banners in that movie, they used a dragon which had 5 claws. And this is very unusual for a dragon. It's the 5 claws clawed dragon of the Chinese royal dragon. Mm. And I'm wondering if you've come across any connections between Merlin being a sage coming from the East, perhaps even a Taoist legendary sage of some sort. And I also, there are interesting connections because Taoist swordsmen were renowned in those early years, at the same time as the Arthurian legend, and supposedly they would quench their swords in a very particular lake, and there's kind of a connection with the sword Excalibur coming out of the lake and going back and so on.
Mm. Good question. I mean, I think there are all kinds of links in here. I haven't personally ever come across anything that suggests that Merlin was an Eastern sage. That there's such a very well-established tradition of Merlin and his followers being, very Western, belonging particularly to Wales, particularly to Britain. But what we are seeing here, I think, is something of the universality of the imagery that comes across in the Arthurian tradition. I mean, things like the sword in the stone or the sword in the lake, there are parallels all over the world with other traditions. I mean, there's one very interesting theory that I came across recently that during the Roman occupation of Britain, there were a number of cavalry units stationed here who were from what we would now call Russia, from the steppe lands. They were Sarmatians. And they had a belief in a hero who was born from a lake, who pulled a sword out of a stone, and had many similarities with Arthur. And they even worshipped a sword stuck in a stone as a kind of image of their particularly unique spiritual beliefs. So you see, there are parallels, you know, in other traditions. I'm just not aware of any specifically Eastern ones with regard to Merlin.
John Michel, who I know you're familiar with, he lives there in Oxford,
yes,
England as well. Well, he points out in New View Over Atlantis some direct connections in his mind between ancient China and some of their traditions and symbols and England and the dragon, and though it has a very different context between the two cultures and some other things, feng shui kind of ideas. We're going to come right back with a couple more phone calls in the remaining minutes with John Matthews. I'm Laura Lee. Laura Lee and the Laura Lee Show. We have just minutes remaining with John Matthews. And John, I know we could go on for the next several hours with more questions and comments from our fellow adventurers. Next call, Paul. Hi, thanks for joining us. Hello, Paul.
Yeah, my question for John is, what is your experience with the Banshees of Ireland? The legend, I guess, is my question. Have you ever had any experience with it, or...
This is an interesting one. The Banshee, as we tend to think of it in modern tradition, is, you know, is this woman who washes clothes at the ford or wails outside the window of a house where someone is about to die. What the name Banshee actually means is Banshee. It's two words. It means woman of the she, and that simply means a woman of the other world. So that, you know, in ancient Irish tradition, you have many traditions of many stories of otherworldly women coming to visit mortals with messages to do with their lives or with the lives of those around them, sometimes with prophecies of their death or prophecies of other things that were about to happen in their lives. I can't say I've ever personally seen one or heard one. Perhaps just as well, but it's certainly a very interesting tradition that has remained alive until this time.
And related to fairies as
very
well.
Very much.
Mm-hmm. Anne, Portland, Oregon, hi.
About 20 years ago, we were at Tintagel, and if Mr. Matthews has been there, he will remember all the signs around Tintagel that say, it's all very nice to be here, and it's beautiful scenery, and interesting and unusual landscape, but there are no indications in actual history that Arthur and his knights were ever there. However, we sat on at the top of the cliff just as you faced Tintagel to the right and had our bit of lunch and looked down at the caves at the bottoms of the cliff. There was one very large one, and I really think that Merlin was there. When we were there.
What do you think? I couldn't hear that one at all.
She thinks that Merlin really was there at Tintagel in the caves on the sea. Thank you, Anne. Let's let him respond.
Yes. Well, I'm not sure about this one. In fact, the traditions relating to Merlin's cave at Tintagel really don't seem to go back any further than the 18th century. And in fact, most of the stories to do with Tintagel were added on in the Middle Ages, although it is an ancient site, and recent excavations have certainly shown that it is a genuinely ancient site, most of the Arthurian traditions were really added on in the Middle Ages. And with regard to the Merlin one, I'm not sure. I mean, there is a tradition which suggests that his name means of the sea. And if that's the case, then, you know, obviously... places that close to the sea, caves and shorelines, all of which were considered to be kind of sacred places because they were partly in this world and partly in the other world. They were in two dimensions, if you like, land and sea. Those are likely to have associations with characters like Merlin, certainly.
But I think also when you go back to an ancient site, it has so many different incarnations of some of the same archetypes that they kind of add on, roll into one, and this and the other. So it's tracing that lineage, you know, difficult, but if you look at some general ideas. You can go back. We're out of time, but John, thank you so much. I hope you join us again in future to tell us more about your extensive and 20 years of research into all of these fascinating areas and this deep philosophy and mythology. That was John Matthews. Thank you for joining us. Hope you join us next time. I'm Laura Lee.
Laura Lee Online, www.lauralee.com.